Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And if the past seems real to you, but the present is a foreign country, you may be suffering from a shipwrecked mind. Put that idea into politics, and you're likely to have a reactionary movement. Make America great again. Restore the caliphate. Take your pick from today or from history. There is an amazing new book of intellectual history and current political analysis called The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction that ends with the words, "Once upon a time." Let's just start there with the author, Columbia University humanities professor Mark Lilla. Maybe you know his previous books, including The Reckless Mind, about how intellectuals who should know better have sometimes come to support authoritarian horrors. That's being reissued shortly. Professor Lilla, thanks for coming on and welcome to WNYC today.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Want to take a couple of minutes and define the word reactionary or reaction as you mean it and talk about the concept from your title, A Mind That's Been Shipwrecked?
Yeah, well, I think the best way to begin thinking about reaction is to contrast it to conservatism. We have a tendency to conflate our terms and our ideas about conservatism, the right, and reaction. Historically, liberals and conservatives have had deep disagreements ever since the 17th century over human nature and the nature of society. For liberals, human beings are morally, in some sense, prior to society. They have rights. Society should be thought of as somehow constituted by individuals coming together, and that to the extent that we have duties, they derive from those rights and the contract we make with each other. Conservatives give a very different picture of political life. They say that we're all born into a pre-existing world. And that world is already established with certain explicit and tacit understandings about how life should be conducted. And because we're part of this flow of this society in time, our obligations come before our rights. And so with these very different pictures of what an individual is and what society is like, we have the kind of conflict we've seen for several centuries. Now, The dispute between reactionaries and revolutionaries, and I'd like to pair those, is really over the nature of history, and it's not over human nature. Revolutionaries and reactionaries primarily think about the course of history, whether history is progressive, whether there are breaks in it. And the revolutionary has a picture of society that of history that assumes that you can make a radical break in history and have a fresh start, and that after the revolution, all will be well. Now, there are lots of books about revolution. If you go to the card catalog of any university, you'll find thousands of books in every language about what revolution is, the concept of it, how they start, why they fail. If you go to the same catalog and look up the word reaction, you'll find the Library of Congress has no category for theory of reaction. And
there'll be chemistry books.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. When in fact, the doppelganger of the revolutionary mind for the past three, four centuries has been the reactionary mind.
So a key concept for you is apocalyptic history and apocalyptic thinking, the thinking that arises after an event that feels epical or apocalyptic, like the Holocaust or September 11th or the establishment of Israel to Palestinian Arabs or the Civil War to white Southerners or the fall of communism to certain disenfranchised Russians. Do you think it takes an apocalypse to create political reactionaries?
Well, I think it takes the idea that there's been an apocalypse, the idea that somehow history has gone off course. There's been a shipwreck. You know, if you think of time as a river flowing by, there's just a shipwreck there. And they find themselves, the reactionaries, on the shores looking at it and feeling that everything that happens after this event is not only terrible, but anything that happens is also caused by the revolution that's taken place.
So, for example, you see today's American conservatives as apocalyptic in thinking there was a golden age after World War II, strong and virtuous, destroyed by the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. How much do you see Trumpism in this light?
Well, I think it's knocking around in there, since it's not a very articulate political movement, to say the least. But
it says "Make America Great Again."
If so, the two words that appear over and over again in reactionary thinking are "once" and "again." And so the idea is either that you go back to a world that existed before and was some bucolic paradise, or you somehow leap out of the present into some future that's a kind of counter-revolutionary future that is inspired by a vision of the past. And Trumpism, I can't figure out which of the two it is because it's not terribly articulate. But the urge there to either go back or move forward is very strong.
In Nazi Germany, to take an example from your book, you see Hitler as having rejected a nostalgic return to a pastoral pre-World War I Germany in favor of growing a hyper-modern industrial one, cleansed of Jews and Bolsheviks, of course. Do you think white American political nostalgia today could go in one direction or the other?
Yes, it's interesting. If you look what happened to neoconservatism in the United States, which I had something to do with back in the 1980s, it was classically conservative in the beginning. And then what happened after the election of Bill Clinton, there was a sense that everything that had taken place in the 60s that they rejected was in fact becoming rooted in society. It wasn't just the product of elite thinking or professors or journalists, but ordinary Americans were starting to think in terms of what had happened in the 60s. And then an apocalyptic strain grew up, especially among the theoconservatives around this magazine called First Things, where they published a special issue back in the 90s. I forget the exact title of the issue, but the question was whether the American regime is any longer legitimate and whether another kind of regime needed to be established because it had been infected by all of these things. That's apocalyptic thinking.
Even the word regime.
Exactly, yeah.
So after describing those American reactionaries near the end of your book, you say things are more serious in Europe, things are critical in Russia, and it's the Muslim world where a belief in a lost golden age is most potent and consequential today. Let me get to each a little bit. Why are things more serious in Europe, in your view, than in the United States in terms of political reaction?
Well, because to begin with, people have historical memory. In a way that Americans do not. And so they have things to appeal to in the past that are very present in their minds. And in Poland, for example, right now that can be a Catholic Poland that's not only prior to the current state of affairs but also prior to communism. Hungary has a sort of invented memory of itself as a place where there were no Jews and gypsies. And the nationalists there would like very much to go back to that imagined time. In Russia, it's clear that Putin is inspired by dreams of a greater Russia of the sort that the USSR was, but inspired by, I don't know, vodka and pillage. I don't know what thinks will inspire it. And then finally, you have Turkey, which is a really interesting case now. Because it's clear that Erdogan wants to think of himself as another Suleiman, as someone who will reestablish something like the Ottoman Empire.
Russia is such an interesting case because an American would assume that life for the average Russian is better now than it was under communism. But apparently there's a nostalgia that seeks to replace the authoritarian leadership and we get Putin.
Yeah, and I think we're a bit surprised by that because we think in terms of – certainly in the United States, in terms of well-being, is how much have incomes gone up and are there job opportunities?
But freedom of speech.
Yeah, and what the reactionary, I think, understands and the conservative does as well in a different way is that people have other collective aspirations and feeling. They want to feel they belong to some – grand project. I just finished rereading Dostoevsky's Demons, or The Devils as it's often called. And in the book, there's extraordinary debates between nihilists who want to create a new world where everyone will be free and Slavophiles. And the Slavophiles not only talk about going back to religious orthodoxy, they talk about going back to a more organic society where everyone felt comfortable. Things weren't changing all the time. There was a kind of implicit commitment people had to each other, a kind of communitarianism. And Dostoevsky intuited how these things would could develop, these very simple ideas. And you see something like that at work in Russia right now at a time when, you know, the economy is not doing well, but people seem willing to trade that, to have that if it means some kind of national greatness.
My guest is Columbia University Humanities Professor and also Russell Sage Foundation Fellow.
Do I have that right? I am this year, yes.
Mark Lilla, with his new book, The Shipwrecked Mind, on political reaction, a work of intellectual history and current political analysis, for just another few minutes. About radical Islam, you provocatively write that despite all the religious invasions of Muslim lands over the many centuries, it was the secularism of the colonial powers who arrived in the 1800s that was uniquely threatening and helped give rise to the extreme reaction of the radicals today. Why the secularism, the modernity of the Western colonizers that you say inspired, you know, the radical Islam that we see today, rather than the colonizers' brutality or their oppression?
In the imagination of the Salafists and radical Islamists, the most radical ones have a very simple idea of history, which is that there was a golden age that was very short, maybe 50 years, the time of Muhammad and of the first four rightly guided caliphs. And during that time, the Sharia was applied, and the Sharia was simultaneously political law, religious law, and moral law. And in their mind, these things are inextricably linked. You can't have one without the other. And so in their books of history, the way they tell their own story, Islam did not have a problem fighting enemies who simply wanted to fight it at the political level and capture territory. But what was particularly insidious about Western secularism is that it presumes that you can break the bond between morality, political organization, and religious faith. So it was the sacralization of society and the demoralization of society that they see in the West.
More than Christians would see it in the West, or Jews?
Well, yes, because in the Christian case, Christianity grew up originally as an anti-political apocalyptic faith. They expected the Messiah to come right back, and Jesus wasn't terribly clear about the relation of Christians to the world and Caesar and all the rest. And because Christians were powerless at the beginning, Christian revelation doesn't claim to establish a certain kind of state or a certain kind of law. Jewish law is meant for the Jews. It's not meant to be universal. And for much of their history, most of their history, the Jews have not had a state. And so the Islamic case is really distinct.
So last question. Your other book, The Reckless Mind, as I mentioned, being reissued with a new afterword. But The Reckless Mind is about intellectuals who cast their lot with authoritarian, murderous regimes in the 20th century, when one might think that educated people would know better. So when we think of political reaction, like with Trumpism, we tend to think of uneducated minds. Where does the reckless mind meet the shipwrecked mind?
Ah, very good question. Going back to Plato understood something deep about the relation of intellectuals to politics, and that is that intellectuals are naturally drawn to tyrants. And that's because,
really?
Yes, because there is or to tyrannical systems, because the dream of some intellectuals is that their own idea about society simply be put into place without consultation, without complications. And so the ambition of the tyrant can be like the ambition of certain intellectuals, unless intellectuals become aware of this tendency and this problem. And I was struck by how this worked out in 20th century European intellectual life. And the book is a series of portraits of thinkers, German and French. Some were on the left, some were communists, some were ended up supporting Nazism. But when you put all the portraits together, you really see a family face of a certain kind of intellectual who doesn't recognize the difficulties of politics, the complications, the bad things that can happen, but through their own passions and their passion even for something good can drive them to be in bed with very tyrannical forces and to deny really the evidence of their eyes.
Now or over time, and this could start a whole other segment between you and me and some other guests, but don't we see around the world intellectuals leading the forces for freedom in repressive societies and the more uneducated masses being those who are most willing to follow reactionary leaders into their dreams of nostalgia?
Well, in the moment we're living in. But, you know, you and I are both old enough to remember the world before 1989 and can remember the Cold War, and one can remember Stalinist intellectuals in this country apologizing for not only what happened in Russia, but apologizing for what happened in certain Latin American countries, what happened in Cambodia. That was not so long ago. So we are living in a very different moment right now, but it's good to remember that these tendencies are there.
Mark Lilla, his new book is The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.